Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology with its sleek mid-cut silhouette. It's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome, tennis fans, to KickServeRadio.com 2024, part of the Tennis Channel Podcast Network, featuring International Tennis Hall of Famer, former world number one, Mats Wilander, and Texas Longhorn all-time great, two-time All-American Johnny Levine. Your host of KickServeRadio.com is Andy Zoden. So, take it away, AZ.
And take it away, I will. Welcome, everybody. KickServeRadio.com, Tennis Channel Podcast Network. And, of course, I am joined by the great Mats Wilander, International Tennis Hall of Famer. Johnny Levine, two-time Texas Longhorn All-American, will be joining me a little bit later in the show. And it's always great to be with you, Mats. The spring hardcourt swing is now in the books. Indian Wells and Miami, and we talked last time we got together about how as long as Alcaraz and or Sinner are sort of center stage, that tennis is in good hands, whether Djokovic and Nadal, or obviously not Federer anymore, are part of the proceedings. And now we've seen Alcaraz win one of these, Sinner win the other. Do you stand by that statement that tennis is in good hands as long as it can kind of rest on the shoulders of those two great young up-and-coming players?
Andy, great to be with you. I completely agree with that. I think tennis is in a really good place. I think a lot has to do with Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz, but they're being pushed by Daniil Medvedev. He's there to the very end. They're proving to everyone that they are slightly better maybe than Daniil Medvedev, or at least on their good days, which I think tells people that tennis is moving in the right direction. Now that Novak Djokovic is not winning everything anymore, it's the fact that they have stepped it up and they're actually better than anybody else, or even better than Novak Djokovic. I'm not sure. It's really hard to go back and sort of think about when Federer and Rafael Nadal, when they had their finals, when they played in Indian Wells. I mean, where was the game at that time? But I think comparing is not good for the sport. But looking forwards, it's in a great place. There are two great guys. There's great players coming behind. Ben Shelton maybe didn't have a great spring here in Indian Wells and Miami, but he's still there. He's dangerous. And I think he's someone that can push these two guys with an American point of view, of course, because we do need an American, and I'm still waiting. We do need an American to step up and really be challenging these two guys, Sinner and Alcaraz, for these titles, especially in Indian Wells and Miami, I think, for tennis here in the U.S.
When you look back, Mats, at where tennis was in the early years of Federer and Nadal, and then eventually Djokovic, it seems like it was trying to figure out what life was going to be like post Sampras Agassi, right? I mean, it was like, oh my God, what are we going to do now when Pete and Andre are stepping away? Well, we had three of the greatest champions that we've ever had and that the sport has ever seen. And to your point, in our lifetimes, we're never going to see anything like that again. One of the big storylines that came out of Miami was the parting of the ways of Djokovic and his longtime coach, Goran Ivanišević, who under Ivanišević, Djokovic won half of the majors that he's won. They won 12 together out of 24. Talk to us about what you suppose happened there and what should be made of all of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've been trying to read up a little bit of what Novak has said about it, and hopefully we can trust that that is what he has said on certain media outlets. It just sounds like they've sort of run into a dead end when it comes to the work that they're doing on the court, is what Novak had mentioned. They're still very, very close friends. They will always be, that bond will always be strong as ever. But I can see that. They've been together for a long time. I mean, it's not just Novak. I mean, his whole team need to fire him up, most probably on most days, whereas when it's a match day, he needs to fire his team up because they need to perform. So I don't find it strange at all. I think Novak has done a great thing in, throughout his career. He obviously started with Marjan Vida, had great success. And then Marjan Vida, you got to give him a lot of credit for sort of allowing Boris Becker to come in there and tell Novak things that Marjan Vida maybe didn't know about because he hadn't won Grand Slams. And then Boris Becker was there. That worked for quite a few years. Boris helped him big time. Andre Agassi, that relationship didn't last very long. Him and Novak tried, but so I think it's a personality thing. And then it becomes more than that. Goran has to be able to fire Novak up on his off days on the practice court. And it's not easy to do. I mean, Goran is, what is he? He's 55 years old, something like that. So he's been traveling his whole life since he was 17. I'm sure at some point he's going to start wanting to not travel as much. And I don't know. You would have thought maybe they would have toughed it out together. But to me, it tells me Novak is not even close to being done. This is not like a swan song. He's not going for one more year. He's going for another 3-4 majors or at least 3-4 seasons. I think that's what it tells me more than anything.
If you look at what the coach and player relationship is like, not just in tennis now, but in all sports, we saw Nick Saban, the legendary football coach at Alabama, step aside because of kind of how things have evolved with regard to the way athletes are being treated and the power that they now have. And even in tennis, when you look at the women's champion in Miami, Danielle Collins, always kind of like, instead of the coaches telling her how to play, she's telling them how to act. Stand up, get up, say this, don't say that. And so maybe, you know, I know that you were out there doing your thing with Murat Safin, and I'm sure that you had a handful there along with some of the other players that you were out there with. Do you think that now, based on kind of the sign of the times of how these athletes want to be able to act, that certain coaches are just finding it very difficult to control their players and maybe stepping aside just by saying, this thing has evolved beyond or in a different direction from what I even understand anymore?
I do. I think that if you look at the relationship that Jannik Sinner has with his coaches, of course, you got to mention Darren Cahill, because really when Darren came in, it's really when the biggest change happened to his game. And when you look at their sort of communication through between points, and Jannik looks over and he smiles sometimes and he laughs at Darren. And what Darren says sometimes is, what did he say at the end of the match in Miami? He said, that's one of the best matches I've ever seen, one of the greatest matches. So I think when you're young, I think you need to know that you need to listen to your coach more than your coach listening to you. But when you get older, in Danielle Collins' case, first of all, what an unbelievable win. How great is that for the tournament? That puts her completely on the map as a great American woman tennis player, because one Grand Slam final and winning Miami is unreal. And I think for her, I can understand it in a way, because she's most probably explored every avenue to improve. She's tried to work on her serve, has improved it. Work on her volleys, have improved it. And at some point, I think you run into a wall where I can't really improve anymore. So now I need my team to get me to play, help me to play at my absolute top level. I'm not learning anything anymore, but I need them to fire me up and be emotionally as involved as I am as a player so that I can perform at 100%. Because if I do, in Danielle Collins' case, for example, she can beat the best players in the world. And she might have beaten the best player in the world in beating Rybakina in the finals.
When I watch a guy like Philip Farmer interact with Austin Krajicek and Ivan Dodig, and I was really impressed to see them so receptive to the things that Philip was telling them. I had an opportunity to sit next to him during one of their matches at Indian Wells. I was heartened to see not only that they were listening, but that what Philip said actually worked and helped them get a great win over Hubert Hurkacz and Telon Griekspoor. But my question is, who do you think right now the coaches have a better during the match effect on from an X's and O's perspective, the doubles coaches or the singles guys?
Yeah, very interesting question. I mean, I think that the coach in doubles, whether there's two in the team and those two are on the court, or there's three in the team that are making choices along the way, I think that matters less. Whereas in singles, okay, it's me by myself. Now there's another guy that's going to help me out. So I think that in singles, it's so individual that it can be a positive thing. In most cases, it might be Juan Carlos Ferrero and Carlos Alcaraz. I mean, to me, Juan Carlos Ferrero is the main reason why Alcaraz turned his tennis around during the Indian Wells tournament and after losing the first set of the tournament and then suddenly turning it around and playing much more solid. And I think Juan Carlos Ferrero should have a lot of credit for that. In doubles, I do feel watching doubles, men or women, just watching Bethany Mattek-Sands play with Sofia Kenin. I mean, that is so, it's fun,
right?
It's entertaining, and the camaraderie that the two of them have, and now you throw Philip Farmer in there helping Krajicek and Dodik. I mean, that is just a fun situation. Doesn't seem to be as serious somehow because all three of us are going to take the hit if we lose. Whereas in singles, you're taking the hit on your own. Mm-hmm. And if the coach feels bad, then maybe that's not the right relationship. So I think there's a massive difference between them. Love watching doubles. I mean, Mattek-Sands and Sofia Kenin, what an unbelievable win that was. After Danielle Collins did it, it's just incredible. And then you throw Grigor Dimitrov on top of that birthday cake. I mean, that's just an unbelievable tournament to me.
When we come back, I want to delve a little bit more into the Grigor issue, because I'm so excited that he's carrying that flag for us one-handers. And I just think that he is a guy that just brings so much to the proceedings, and he does it the right way. You can't help but love the guy. When we come back on kickserveradio.com, Grigor Dimitrov will start out the segment. Don't go away. More with Mats Wilander right after this.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Welcome back, everybody. KickServeRadio.com, Tennis Channel Podcast Network, AZ, and Mats Wilander. Johnny Levine will be joining me in the next segment. And Mats, when we left off, you had just brought up Grigor Dimitrov, and there were two things about Grigor's, well, more than two. I mean, it was scintillating, and it was exciting, and it was just nice to have Grigor back in the top 10. First time since 2018. Again, the return, thank goodness, for my sake, just for old time's sake, of a one-handed backhand back in the top 10 in the world. And it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. The other comment that you made when we were talking earlier was, is there still a place, an effective place for the slice backhand in today's game? And I would argue that Grigor makes a great argument for the effectiveness of that slice backhand, that one-hander, and just having Grigor back in the limelight, I think is tremendous for men's tennis.
I mean, first of all, the person that Grigor is on and off the court is just, to me, he's perfect. He's a great champion. He's won enough to be called a great champion, but it's more about his behavior on the court is absolutely brilliant. He cares as much as anyone. He gets upset as much as anyone, but he's able to hold it in at times, and then you feel for him when he can't hold it in and gets frustrated. So I think he's perfect. He's great off the court, obviously. Such a nice guy. I mean, I've heard through you know, rumors that he's good looking, Andy. I'm not sure. I can't really go there, but
my wife may have mentioned it.
Yeah. Okay. So no, it's absolutely brilliant. When you talk about the slice, I mean, you got to keep the ball out of the strike zone these days when you play Alcaraz and Sinner. And keeping out of the strike zone is either hit a winner over there to their forehand, or you keep it low where they have to bring it over the net with a bunch of topspin. So I think there is a place for the slice backhand for sure. The one-handed backhand, we had a couple of months maybe where there was no one-handed backhand in the top 10. That had never happened since they introduced the ATP computer ranking in the 70s, 73, 74. That was just the first period. So question to you, because you brought it up, Andy. So more than the one-handed topspin backhand, which is a beautiful stroke, to me, the most beautiful stroke in tennis, The slice to me is the most interesting shot in tennis because it skims over the net by a couple of inches, and it very often lands very close to the baseline. But what else does a one-handed backhand bring, do you think? Because you have one, Andy. What does it bring to the game in terms of, does it feel like, oh, at any time he could hit a slice back and come to the net, or at any time, you know what I mean? What other avenues does it open up just because he has a one-handed backhand?
I think it probably gets you a little bit more, ability to defend out of the corners as Grigor does so well. I think it obviously keeps a grip in your hand that you stay accustomed to, that when you get to the net, you're going to be able to volley with a backhand similar to what you would get from a slice backhand grip. And, back in the day, Mats, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a guy back in 1988 that won the US Open. And there are some that would suggest that he won that US Open based on the fact that he had developed a slice backhand. I can't remember. Oh, that's right. It was you. And so I think Mattson, you can obviously have the final word on this, but it seems like the Djokovic backhand out of the corner, the Sinner backhand, the Alcaraz backhand, they can turn defense to offense a little bit more readily with the two-hander than a Dimitrov does. But And yourself, guys that run as well as you guys do and move as well as you guys do can just defend unbelievably well and give yourselves time to reset the point. Whereas I think Djokovic in particular, probably better than anybody that's ever played the game, can really just, it's like a wrestler that just turns a guy over and all of a sudden he's on top of him and he's turned that defense to offense in the blink of an eye. That seems to me to be the big difference.
Absolutely, that's the big difference. And I think the other part that we never really, no one ever talks about, is the difficulty level of hitting a topspin one-handed backhand and then mixing it up and hitting a one slice backhand and then trying to go back and hit a topspin backhand and another slice. Compare that to Sinner, who hits two hands all the time, and the difference between one backhand to the next is maybe a couple of percentage points, maybe a couple of miles, but it's the same stroke, it's the same back of the ball, on and on and on. And with Dimitrov, he's basically would be like a professional golfer hitting a draw one shot, and then the next shot he's going to hit a fade, and then he hits a draw. And it's not easy. And we know in golf, they like to go to their shot, which often is a fade. If Dimitrov just hits slice backhands, he's not beating these guys. So I think what he did was he found that perfect mix of being aggressive, hitting through it, hitting down the line enough, hitting enough drop shots with the slice that I think he put people on the edge of their seats. And the atmosphere, because of Grigor in the finals, in that first set when he was close, I mean, that's his tennis. It's his personality, but it's his tennis that makes people, it draws them in somehow, and they can kind of relate to what he's doing, even though it's at a level that I can hardly relate to it.
As we move into the clay court season now, Mats, based on what you've seen on both the men's and women's side, is there anything that we can take from these hard court results and sort of project onto what we should expect to see on the dirt?
I definitely think so. I think that if we start with Jannik Sinner, first of all, I do believe that, well, if I was coaching Jannik Sinner, Darren Cahill obviously would know better than me, but I have this feeling that if Jannik Sinner is going to win the French Open, he cannot start his clay court season playing anywhere differently than he does on hard courts. He has to play hard court tennis, and it's not going to work the first couple of weeks on clay, potentially.
Maybe in Madrid.
He's going to keep missing Monte Carlo. It's too early. But I think he needs to stay like he's playing now. And then by the time he gets to the French Open, then he plays hard court tennis on a clay court with a few different variations, with some spin, and obviously sliding is slightly different, but not really. So I think Sinner will be great at the French Open. I wouldn't think that after what he's done so far. I can only imagine that he's going to have some kind of letdown in a couple of events on clay, cold temperatures, heavy tennis balls in Monte Carlo. Carlos Alcaraz, to me, I think he is kind of the same thing, but he is more natural on clay. And I think that he will have weeks where you cannot beat him. You can't get by him. He's too fast. His forehand is still lethal, even if it's cold in Monte Carlo, dry in altitude in Madrid. So I think Carlos Alcaraz is going to be there. Question is Novak for me. Where does he go? Does he go into grind mode where he goes into lockdown, makes sure that he wins a couple of matches in Monte Carlo, make sure he doesn't lose to guys, no lucky losers, no one out of the top 50? Or does he say, you know what, forget it? Because last year he lost to Davidovich Fokina in Monte Carlo, and we thought, oh, that didn't look that good. I'm wondering about Novak. And then what happens, of course, he wins the French Open.
Right.
And he's the best clay-court player in the world. So I think for him, it's a mindset. Does he want to play that kind of tennis now on clay that he needs to play to win the French? Or does he need some confidence by winning a few matches? I don't know. I can't put myself. I would think confidence is... He's got an overflow of confidence, I think, Novak, once it's 3 out of 5 in Paris.
So sometimes that reboot, Matt, whether it's going to a new racket or going to something different in your life, and in this case, it's going to be a new coaching team, is it the reboot that he needs to finish off whatever is left of his career? In your opinion, he's still got several years left. And maybe, I mean, athletically and physically, he certainly looks that way. Although in Australia, he claimed he didn't play very well. We saw what happened at Indian Wells, and then he opts out of Miami. But this coaching reboot, to me, seems like it's going to go a long way toward determining the mindset that is instilled in him to get him started on the right foot on the dirt.
I think 100% that reboot is, I don't know if it's necessary, but I think it's great. And I think you could just look at what happened to Jannik Sinner. He was working with Riccardo Piatti, one of the most respected coaches in the world, coach Ivan Ljubicic, and so many great players. And for us, looking at Jannik Sinner early in his career, it's like, oh, he just made the quarterfinals of the French Open. Working with Riccardo Piatti. He's only 19 years old. Oh, and remember, Andy, I used to talk about Jannik 2-3 years ago.
More than that.
I thought he was on the right path. He was improving week by week by week, every year getting better. But I don't think I realized that he has that much potential, that if he starts working with the likes of Darren Cahill, suddenly it's a different player. It's a completely different level. So for Novak, I think the same thing could happen in a way where, okay, we're not getting anywhere anymore with Goran Ivanišević for whatever reason, because no one can be, I don't know how much more you can teach Novak Djokovic on a tennis court, but there might be one guy out there who he's going to listen to and who might come up with simple things. Maybe we should try and get a little more out of your racket so we can put a little more spin on the forehand or a little more spin. I don't know what the answer is, but I do feel that there might need to be some kind of a reboot, not just emotionally, because I can't speak to that, but technically, so that he plays a little more like he did in the Australian Open last year, where he says, listen, I'm the one that decides what's going to happen, and that's it. Not listening to Carlos or Jannik. This is me. And I think he needs to go there at some point throughout this year. But hey, once he starts winning, I bet you our conversation would be the opposite, Andy. Who's the favorite now? Oh, Novak. He against the field. I'm taking Novak. So I'm expecting him to be one of the two, three favorites at the French Open, clearly.
Well, maybe it's what we're looking for here in Matt's. Maybe what you/we are trying to put our fingers on is what Novak needs is kind of, for lack of a better description, kind of that, call it the Brad Gilbert effect, which is we're not really sure what he's saying. We just know it's got high energy. We know it makes you feel real good about yourself. We know it makes you feel about the best you can possibly feel about yourself, and that you just somehow figure out a way to take that out on the court with you. And certainly not to say that Brad isn't a good X's and O's guys and he's not a good technician, because certainly he is. But as you know, because you played, you know, in the same era as he did, he got a lot out of his game for a long time. And I think he's had a really good effect on Andre Agassi and Andy Roddick and Andy Murray and everybody else, and Coco Gauff most recently, to be able to help these players find the best version of themselves, at least for a period of time.
I couldn't agree more. I think the only thing with someone like Brad Gilbert, I guess, that he gets his players pretty early in their career. Agassi, not as early as Roddick or Andy Murray or Coco Gauff. But so I think there's a lot to teach these guys. Whereas with Novak, I think he most probably needs to learn something new, if everybody that's listening know what I mean. I mean, what does that mean? Well, he needs to, oh, I never thought of that tactical move, or I never thought of serving like that, or coming to the net on that shot, something that he hasn't thought about. Kind of like Agassi came up in the late 80s, and I played him a couple of times, and we kind of thought, Andre Agassi does not know how to volley at all, because look at him. He's hitting topspin volleys on every single volley. He can't actually hit a proper volley, is what we called it. Turns out Agassi was, instead of being behind technically, he was actually ahead of the rest of us, because now how many guys are hitting, and women, topspin volleys, and they are the right shot. So I think Novak, he needs something there that fires him up with his tennis. If he could find a little more 5 miles an hour on the serve or something, I think that you will have a new Novak, because the difference between him at 36, 37 and Rafael Nadal or even Roger Federer is that he doesn't really seem to be late 30s. He seems to be late 20s physically. And that's the biggest difference between him and all the other guys that have tried to play into their late 30s, to me.
Well, maybe what he's looking for, maybe I misspoke with Brad Gilbert. Maybe it's more along the lines of what Roger was looking for. And he tried with Stefan Edberg and he tried with Paul Anacone. And to some degree, I think eventually somebody got through to him, because he started in, and maybe that new thing for Roger, remember, was the saber. Remember?
Yeah.
He'd come in and he'd take the, you know, almost like a half volley return to serve. And all of a sudden there he was at the net, and sneaking in, and, you know, extra little bit of head size in the racket head so that he could hurt Rafa, you know, on the backhand side a little bit more. And certainly it bore fruit in 2017 and 2018. And I think it sounds to me like maybe what Novak is looking for was what Roger got in those years, that was just a little bit of a tweak of aggressiveness and getting to the net. And who better to be able to study under than your boy Stefan Edberg, and certainly Paul Anacone, two of the best that ever did it.
Again, I couldn't agree more. I would love to see Novak. Imagine Novak Djokovic, the best returner of all time. Remember, imagine if he starts doing the saber a little bit, or saben, sudden sneak attack by Novak. With two hands on the backhand, with his return skills, with his reaction, if he could throw that in every third, second serve, suddenly the whole game opens up in his eyes. Obviously, it'll be tough for the other guys, but in Novak's eyes, something like that could really spark something in Novak Djokovic. And I'm not sure that might be the right thing to do. Listen, we're going to take every service return that's a short serve, take it, and we're coming in after it. So you're going to shorten the points. You're going to scare the hell out of any opponent, and it's going to make him feel fresh about the game. I mean, we're talking about the greatest player of all time, and he's had a couple of unfortunate losses. So, but it's interesting to talk about Novak, because once Novak is gone, and it's not more than 3 or 4 years, I wouldn't think, the greatest era in tennis is gone. So it's very clear that Federer and Nadal pushed Novak to be as good as he is right now. He would never have gotten there without Roger and Rafa, in my eyes. And I think Novak, I'm not ready to let Novak go yet, because I think he is one person, one player that can ask difficult questions to Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz. And by asking those difficult questions during a match tactically, these guys will, oh, I need to improve more, because Novak is exploiting my weaknesses. So I'm not quite ready yet to let Novak go, when I am being very selfish and only thinking about the level of where tennis is going. I think it can go higher, but I do think we need Novak in there for a couple of more years to push him.
The best substance with which to sharpen a knife is a diamond. It sounds like the new knives in the game are Alcaraz and Sinner, and the diamond is Novak Djokovic, because he's won more than any of them. Mats, thanks so much. Always great to get together and do what we do. And don't go away, everybody. Johnny Levine's going to have Johnny's hot list when we come back. And that's always going to be, who are the guys that are on the brink of making some noise out there? And as we go to the clay court season, there's got to be a few guys that are ready to do some running and ready to push these older guys. Johnny's going to have that list when we come back. You're listening to KickServeRadio.com, part of Tennis Channel Podcast Network. So please don't go away.
Hi guys, Sarah Z here with a Kick Serve Quick Serve with my friend and nutrition guru, Courtney Ward with Body Fuse. Courtney, as we ladies start to get, oh, shall I say, more advanced or more experienced in our life, how about just body weight and body maintenance? That for me is becoming, I think, tougher by the day.
Boy, you're not alone. And along with our sports performance line, Body Fuse also offers a full weight loss line. And we have a fantastic product called Purify, which kickstarts your weight loss. It's a GI detox. It's a water cut as well. So it's really great for bloating, irregularity. And people love it to kickstart a weight loss program. And then with that, we couple a product called Blackwall Shredded, kind of a cool name. It's a daytime thermogenic and also has a nootropic in it. It's not super high stimulant, but it's just a good mental focus. And it just basically kickstarts your metabolic rate. So that's a daytime thermogenic. We also offer a nighttime thermogenic called Midnight Burn. And this has melatonin and GABA as well as a thermogenic. So it kind of continues that metabolic rate bump, if you will. So that these three products are sort of like the magic trinity. I don't want to say magic pills because there's no such thing, but Midnight Burn at night, Blackwall Shredded in the day, and then Purify to kind of kickstart your system and clean out your GI tracts. And in addition, Purify, along with the detox, it allows us to start absorbing nutrients a little bit more efficiently as well. So those three products are just a fantastic trio and very, very popular.
Fantastic. And one more time, Body Fuse.
BodyFuseUSA.com.
Well, I'm Sarah Z. She's Courtney with Body Fuse. And now back to more tennis talk with the KickServe Radio Boys.
And welcome back, everybody. Final segment, KickServeRadio.com, part of Tennis Channel Podcast Network. As promised, Johnny Levine joins us. And Johnny, we were going to do the Johnny Levine hot list, Johnny's hot list, but you were like wanting to turn the tables. You want to ask me a few things. So I guess I better get ready to get peppered here. So what would you like to know?
Here's Johnny.
Well, Andy, what's been on my mind is the one-handed backhand.
All right. That's one of the things in tennis, one of the very few things in tennis that I can actually speak to a greater extent than you. I did not know that a subject existed like that, but I hit a one-hander and you don't. So yes, let's talk about it.
Well, and that's why I wanted to bring it up, because I always loved your one-hander.
Thank you.
The forehand with the continental.
Now, by the way, I've had this conversation with Talbot Davis as well, because he teases me to this day unmercifully. I have worked very hard over the last 25 or 30 years to move that continental grip all the way over to, I would call it, a semi-eastern.
Okay.
So it's about a 16th of an inch off of a continental now. So I'm very proud of that.
I like to hear that. But your backhand, beautiful looking one-handed stroke, and the fact that we had actually gone a few weeks without a one-hander in the top 10, we were back in it with Grigor Dimitrov. Tell me what your thoughts are on the fact that there's just so few guys remaining that have the one-hander. What are your thoughts in the future about that stroke?
You know, I think that the problem is that slice backhand that Grigor hits and that Roger hit and that all the great one-handers hit were, and in fact, Mats won the U.S. Open in 88 with that slice backhand. And that slice backhand is great to defend the court and to reset the point. But in the case of a Novak Djokovic or a Carlos Alcaraz or a Jannik Sinner, that two open stance two-hander out of the corner doesn't just create defense. It creates defense to offense. And I think that's what's missing from the one-hander's ability to then kind of really turn the point completely around. You can reset the point, with the one-hander. So I think this is a blip on the radar to not have any one-handers in the top 10. That being said, I would be surprised if we ever get to a point again where we're 50-50 with one-handers and two-handers. Those days are gone. It is nice to see the occasional one-hander. Johnny, think back to when we used to watch maybe what was one of the greatest contrasts of styles in the history of tennis, which was when we used to watch Patrick Rafter play Andre Agassi on grass at Wimbledon. And the aesthetic beauty that those two contrasting styles, obviously Federer and Nadal, that spoke for itself, the way those, how differently, really, and Djokovic too, all three of those played such a different game that I think we really enjoyed those matchups because these were like really different athletes. And I think that's what the one-hander gives us that we don't have now, is that difference, that stylistic difference. And I just think it really is a graceful and beautiful shot, very athletic. Matt's talked about the fact that you can use it maybe as a little bit of a sneak attack to approach off of, whereas with the two-hander, you might not get the two-hander to come forward off of a short ball the way someone with a one-handed slice might be able to. But to see Grigor back in the top 10, to make a short story long, I think that it's nice to have that guy back in the top 10, not to mention the fact that who doesn't love Grigor Dimitrov just as a person and just to look at the guy?
Yeah, he's a great guy and a classy guy. And, you know, he'd been out of the top 10 for quite a long time. I believe that he's considered, you know, one of the hardest working guys on the tour. People know it. And I think that he's well deserving of being back in the top 10. And it brings me to a point where, I mean, here he is in the semifinals of Miami, and he's playing Carlos Alcaraz.
Actually, that was the quarters. He played Zverev in the semis.
Correct. He did beat Zverev in the semis. But let's talk about that quarterfinal match, because you guys seem to, you know, you and Matt talk about big victories by guys, and then all of a sudden they lose in the next tournament, and you're ready to write them off. And I'd like to know what you think now. Here he wins Indian Wells, Alcaraz, and he gets to the quarters and he loses 4-2 to Dimitrov.
2-4, yeah.
Tell me your thought now. What?
Well, I think obviously at age 20, if Carlos's results, I suspect, were win Indian Wells, lose early to a lucky loser in Miami, I might be more concerned than to lose to a guy like Grigor, who's going good, who happened to have the right game plan. And it's so tough to win that sunshine double. I think that, you know, again, we're not going to have these guys that are just going to win a tournament, then win a tournament, then win a tournament, then win a tournament. I just think asking that is a lot. Now, if you're asking for a guy to win a tournament and then be competitive in the next tournament, I think Alcaraz did that. Now, the question that I would ask back of you is, what we used to see from Grigor a lot of times was the big win followed by the inability to validate that win, not just in the next tournament, but oftentimes in the next round, which is why I was so heartened for him to see him get the win over Alcaraz, which you would think might have taken a lot of emotion out of the tank, and then still go out there and be so close to beating Zverev in two sets, only to let the second set get away in a tiebreaker, but then come back and win the third and then back up the Alcaraz win with a Zverev win when it looked for all the world like Zverev was going to win that thing 2 or 3 in the third, to me. And then, of course, obviously came up against, you know, the locomotive that is Jannik Sinner right now, with what we saw him do to Medvedev. And then, of course, to Grigor. I still consider that to be kind of a breakthrough for Grigor. Now, my question is, will he go to the clay season and be able to be an 8 in the world level player during these clay court events?
Well, Dimitrov, I believe, had some success last year at the French Open, plays very well on clay. So I believe he'll have some good results, and he could surprise you and get deep into, you know, the Italian Open or the French Open. But So I think, you know, he's an all around, all court player. They can play well on all surfaces. That's one of his great advantages. And I do think that his conditioning looks phenomenal. He's in tremendous shape. You know, he's still a young guy. He's in his early 30s and has the confidence, obviously, now that he can beat top guys. And so I think he's going to be a solid top 15 guy for the next couple of years. I think he's, you know, his consistency, you're right, in the past, he's had big wins and then losses, but let's see what he does. I mean, he's had some really strong results the last 18 months, and I think he'll keep it going. You know, Andy, I'm going to switch gears here a little bit.
Okay.
Let's talk about a couple guys that we think could be the next future stars.
Okay.
And we're all to pick out that guy that might be 30, 40, 50, 80 in the world that's going to jump to the top 10.
Okay.
And hard to do because there's so many great players. And that's my point to you when I mentioned, you know, Alcaraz losing to Dimitrov, and now is everyone on the ledge thinking, you know, Alcaraz is finished. My whole thing,
I don't think anybody thinks he's
finished from being, you know, the going to finish number one in the world.
That's okay.
With guys, especially now that the big three are really not the big three anymore, the depth is just so insane. The guys, it's just, it takes a Djokovic, a Nadal, and a Federer, three guys like that, to just know that it's so unlikely that they're going to lose before they meet each other. And that's kind of what was the case. They rarely were upset by guys outside the top 20. But in today's game, the guys are so good, the depth is so great, that a guy like, you know, that's one or two or three in the world, Medvedev, Alcaraz, Sinner, it's not going to surprise me if, you know, you go to Monte Carlo and Sinner loses in the second round or third round to a guy like Musetti. I mean, it just can happen. Now, at the big stage, you would hope that these guys are geared up, nerves play a part, and that the guys with that slight edge are going to get through. But on a weekly grind on the tour, upsets are just, they're just bound to happen all the time.
Okay, so here's what I'll finish with on that. First of all, you're going to see the cream rise to the top in the majors because it's best of five.
Right.
And that's always going to be advantage Djokovic, advantage mentally tough guy, advantage guy that's been there, guy that's done that, right? This is where we see separations. But to say what you're saying right now, Johnny, is not – I don't think that's big news. I think what was surprising, and in talking to our mutual friend Tom Fontana – he talked all the time about how disappointed he was during the reign of Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and Murray, that there weren't more young guys that were occasionally upsetting the apple cart. So basically what you're saying now is that now we don't have that, and we do have guys that are upsetting the apple cart. And we could have a Ben Shelton serve his way to a Grand Slam win. And we could have a guy like Alex de Minaur go out for 2 weeks and not miss a ball. And we could have a guy like Grigor Dimitrov catch fire and hit the most beautiful 2 weeks worth of slice backhands since Mats Wilander in 1988. And it's out there and it can happen. Then the question begs to be asked, is that what tennis fans want? It's what you want. It's what I want. It's not what mainstream fans want. And so that's the problem. A comment was made that, you know, Sinner's maybe not the greatest thing for ratings. And that's just because he's kind of, you got to start somewhere. Either was Federer when he first won Wimbledon. Federer wasn't, it took a while for people to have that familiarity and to have the appreciation of his greatness. And then suddenly Nadal's greatness. And then suddenly Djokovic's greatness. And suddenly we wake up 10 years later and go, oh my God, in the last 10 years, we've had 40 majors and these guys have won 38 of them. Or, you know, whatever the number was. And so now we know that that is over. And so to your point, you're right. I mean, we're going to see Jannik Sinner go from losing in the semis of Indian Wells and winning in Miami and winning in Australia to go to the clay court season. And I think he's going to do well. I don't think he's going to just win everything. Like, nobody's going to dominate the clay court season the way Nadal ever did. Nobody's going to dominate the grass season the way Sampras or Federer did. Not in this game today. Not once Djokovic goes away. So now what we're going to have is, to your point, a depth of the game free for all.
Exactly.
And if somebody proves us wrong, then let that person raise their hand now. Sinner certainly looks like a guy that has said, excuse me, Carlos Alcaraz, I got something to say about this. And I think that with Darren Cahill at his side, that is certainly the right guy to guide you through those kinds of waters and to go from winning a big tournament to not having that precipitous drop-off. I think that's a secret weapon for him, because I think Darren Cahill really stands above a lot of these other coaches in not just telling these players what they want to hear, but being able to stand there and get in their face with his arms crossed and his Australian accent and go, sorry, mate, we're not done yet. You know, and then the guy go, really, we're not done? And then, no, we're not done. And I'll let you know when we are. And that's what I love about Cahill. He's not out there for himself. He's out there for his player, but he knows what those people need, and those players respect that guy. And I think it's going to be really cool to watch on a go forward. I think it's Alcaraz and Sinner's game right now. Djokovic is still going to have something to say about it, but Medvedev, Zverev, Tsitsipas, I think if it was going to be those guys, we'd have seen it by now.
Well, and now we talk about the youth of the game, and Alcaraz at 20 years old and Sinner at 22. You know, Rune is 20 years old.
He seems to have, like, to your point, he seems to have retreated a little bit and kind of regressed.
Well, and we don't know what's to happen in the future.
There's an injury or what? Yeah,
just don't know. But the guy that I was going to talk about, that I'm going to pick out of this top 30 guys that I think is going to shoot up, and you're actually not even in the top 30. He's 37 in the world, but he's the youngest guy in the top 40. Might even be the youngest guy in the top 50. Actually, he is. And that's Arthur Fields.
Arthur Fee.
I'm really good with those names. But this is French, and he's one of the best athletes on tour. He's 19 years old, and he's 37 in the world. And this is a guy that that people are talking about. Big things for him. And, you know, he'll be heading to the French Open here soon, his home slam. And I think he's the guy to watch to be your next top 10 guy soon.
I'll tell you why I like that before we check out, is because last week on the show, 2 weeks ago, your boy Alex Gruskin threw out that name, Arthur Fee. And that's the reason I know how to pronounce it, was because Gruskin brought that name up last week. And I said, who are the young guys that we got? Oh, you got to watch Arthur Fee. So to his point,
yeah,
you just concurred. So, you know, Gruskin, he knows of what he speaks within his own age group. And unfortunately or unfortunately, I think we're probably pretty wise to defer to that young guy. I mean, he knows of what he speaks. So anyway, for Mats Wilander and Johnny Levine, I'm Andy Zoden. This is KickServeRadio.com, part of Tennis Channel Podcast Network. We're off to the clay courts, everybody, and we will catch you in a couple of weeks.